Hi everyone, I'm Lori Hennessy and this is Washington Game Changers, and it's a podcast that we have at League of Education Voters, and it's an opportunity to talk to people who do good things in the community and people who are making a difference in our Washington community. So my guest today is one of those people, and my guest is Karen Pruitt, who I have known for many years. We both live on Vashon Island, and she knows, I think, everyone on Vashon Island. But today we're talking to Karen because she has come out with a book about a very famous, I guess I would say a very famous case, a very famous person, and a very famous sort of moment in time where maybe we as Americans were not our best selves. And I think there's a lot we can learn from that time period. So with that, I want to introduce Karen. Hi, Karen. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll talk about the book. So first of all, how about you? Give us an idea of how you came to write this book.
Well, it was a bit like a snowball rolling downhill. Amanda.
Amanda Knox, I should say.
Amanda Knox, yeah. This is about Amanda Knox. Her dad is a family friend. And so when she was arrested in Italy, my family heard about it about 3 days later. And I like to tell people that if the investigation had been handled correctly, nobody would know Amanda. And the only people that would have heard her roommate was killed was her immediate family and mm-hmm. her close friends. I'm about 3 degrees out from her, and I doubt if I would have heard about it. I like to tell people that if the investigation had been handled correctly in the very beginning, none of us would be talking about Amanda. And it's quite likely that I would probably maybe hear that her roommate had been killed. That would have stayed within her circle. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's one of the biggest things of this case is how it blew up because of poor investigation. And in some ways, I feel like Amanda was targeted herself. Mm-hmm. For being an American, and you know, and I have my own conspiracy theories about that. Mm-hmm. But the end result was that Amanda became a search word on Google, mm-hmm. and that's a really awful thing to happen to a private citizen. Yeah. If you're not seeking fame, mm-hmm. then everything you have gets opened up, and her incredible bravery mm-hmm. dealing with this is one of the things that just makes me so proud of her. And it, you know, it just is amazing to me that she has the guts mm-hmm. to just be open about all kinds of stuff. And her family as well, mm-hmm. watching our friends suffer through this, they're just incredibly, incredibly brave. And I had a small moment of my own where I had gone to a studio in Seattle and I was about to be interviewed by Piers Morgan. But when Amanda landed and spoke to the crowd, I got bumped, which was totally mm-hmm. fine. I was, you know, fish out of water. Mm-hmm. But prepping for it really brought home to me everything that Kurt and Etta had been dealing with. And not just them. It was also Raffaele's family, the Solecitos. These mm-hmm. were also private citizens who were thrust into the spotlight and had to defend their children from really heinous accusations. And then watching the trolling in mm-hmm. social media, where I was a complete newbie to that.
Yeah.
3 years into it was where I had my moment, where mm-hmm. there was so much happening and so many awful things. And I'd become aware that there were people holding fundraisers for Amanda's defense fund. Mm-hmm. And so I spoke to my family and they introduced me to a couple friends. We, you know, friends, you know, it's a small yeah. community. We all know each other's friends. And mm-hmm. a couple of them helped with putting together a fundraiser for her defense fund. And mm-hmm. that was really the beginning. I wrote an article for the Beachcomber about the fundraiser, and it literally snowballed from that point on. And now here I am 15, you know, what, 13, 14 years later, and I have a book. And the book is accumulation of working with the crowd. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about crowdsourcing, this mm-hmm. book embodies it. Everything in it was either a question I was asked personally, mm-hmm. or it was something we discussed on our forums or social media. And so that's probably one of the biggest things that I want the public to know about this mm-hmm. book mm-hmm. is that if you want to see crowdsourcing and hold it in your hands, mm-hmm. this is it.
If we could step back for 1 second. So the general public remembers, and I'm being a little bit oversimplifying here. They remember that Amanda was a student in Italy who was accused of this real horrible murder and was put in prison. I think for a lot of people, they have not really accepted or heard or understood that it has been completely proven that that was false. Can you recap or share that? Because I still think I hear from people still that there's a lack of true understanding that was turned over essentially.
Yeah, and it took a while, but this is the epitome of the lie that gets around the world before mm-hmm. the truth yeah. has its pants on. And this yeah. is one of the most dangerous things we're facing with media, mm-hmm. is that the police leaks that came out in the days between when Meredith's body was found. It was Meredith Kircher, and she was mm-hmm. an English student, mm-hmm. and her and Amanda were in Italy in Perugia, which is yeah. a you know, fairly small town up on a hill. So mm-hmm. kind of has the small town thing like West Seattle does. There's mm-hmm. lots of people, but it's still kind of an enclosed environment. And the investigation, and there's different information about what happened, mm-hmm. but the investigation went off the rails almost right away. Mm-hmm. And one of the things the book covers is watching the media, you know, in hindsight, over that first week, and watching the police leaks introduce the various elements that they would present in court. So the public was steeped in the prosecution theories before they became an official prosecution theory. And this is exactly how gossip treats people regardless of where they're at in their life. I mean, this is something we deal with in the schoolyard, in our homes with our brothers and sisters, you know, complaining about us. In work, if somebody doesn't like your work ethic, they might complain about you. In government, we are all witnessing what mm-hmm. is going on with the Democrats and the Republicans. Mm-hmm. But what I see now in hindsight is the exact same type of behavior. And so I'm realizing this is human behavior. So what happened to Amanda in Italy was prejudiced mm-hmm. and it was jumping the gun. The mm-hmm. police did not finish their investigation before they interrogated these students. And mm-hmm. when you go back and look at the paperwork and the information that I've drawn together and sourced, you can see it. You can actually see the police prejudice, which is against the law in Italy, yeah. and you can see the misuse of information, and this includes the forensic information. Mm-hmm. So the way that this bled out into the media was they were literally allowed to use Amanda and Raffaele as punching bags. They mm-hmm. made up whatever they wanted. Mm-hmm. They spread it all over. And one of the key places for this happening was in Britain. And when yeah. they were using the Daily Mail yeah. and the Mirror and the Sun. And these are humongous, massive tabloids. Mm-hmm. And Daily Mail, if I remember right, has one of the largest readerships on the planet.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah. And so when you are reading something in Seattle that has been filtered through police leaks and then filtered through the tabloids. Mm-hmm. And you're reading it in the Seattle Times, and it's got the byline off the AP wire.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I was deeply studying this that I actually, you know, because my group, we were seeing things as they were released in Italy and Great Britain, and mm-hmm. discussing them. And then I would see, on average, about 3 days later, I would see the exact article by the tabloid reporter that was filled with lies in the Seattle Times.
Wow.
And so this is how tabloids bleed into mainstream media, and there's no fact checking because mm-hmm. everybody is so intent on getting the story first. They mm-hmm. want to break that news. And when you take this behavior and you can filter it, like I said, clear down to the schoolyard mm-hmm. and see the exact same behavior happening. And this is how Amanda's reputation was destroyed. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I want to point out is that the Italians never came to Seattle,
mm-hmm.
never spoke to her doctors, never spoke mm-hmm. to her teachers. They had absolutely zero background on what kind of person Amanda Knox was, mm-hmm. who her family was. And the only thing that the tabloids picked up on was that her parents were divorced. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they immediately, well, she's just a bad girl. And then, mm-hmm. you know, because her parents are divorced. And then they also, because Italy and Great Britain jumped on the anti-Americanism.
Yeah.
She must be prejudiced because she's a pampered white girl.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you saw the classic othering mm-hmm. things happened. And the public in general does not see that. You know, mm-hmm. Nowadays we have to think about critical thinking about everything that we read and see, mm-hmm. all the books we read. Everything needs to be taken with a grain of salt. And mm-hmm. then if you have the wherewithal, like they say, go do your research.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and to do research, you have to be a special personality. You're the one that reads to page 15 on Google.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And most people won't do that. And so they will read the headlines. They might read the first paragraph. And then they internalize it. And that's human nature to see what you saw first and internalize. Yeah. And that's where Amanda is at right now, is she is having problems breaking those barriers because people have, they're so entrenched in what yeah. they first learned about her, which was yeah. all lies.
Yeah.
And they have the cognitive dissonance. And again, this is something that the average public person yeah. is not particularly aware of. And so sometimes we don't know we're actually doing that. And
unlearning once you've learned yeah. it is more hard.
It is, and it's just human nature. But mm-hmm. even myself, being in part of her advocacy, listening mm-hmm. to the opposite side, we called them the guilters because yeah. they believed in guilt.
Yeah.
And they would say stuff. And, you know, and of course, I know her family, I know the truth, and I would find myself doubting, and I would have to go back and re-research that particular point. So it's a very tricky, hard thing for people to stop doing it. You know, you really have to train yourself. And there were things when I was finally sitting down to write this book, it took 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if I ever decide to source every single sentence in a book again, you know, it's like, just throw me in the loony bin right now. So as I'm sourcing every single sentence in this book, that's when I came across things where I had cognitive dissonance about something mm-hmm. and realized how wrong I was about it. And one of those had to do with the University of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I was angry with them for a few years that they had kind of left Amanda out to dry, because that was the popular thought at the time, you know, mm-hmm. back in like 2010, 2011, was that they hadn't done a thing. Mm-hmm. And here I am years and years later, sitting down to do my book, and I come across that Amanda had a person at the University of Washington named Annie Fuller, who is checking up on her daily and keeping track of her throughout the first week, and had gotten with the Seattle Perugia Sister City program and had set up an apartment for her and her mom when Etta came into town. So the University of Washington was indeed taking good care of her. And I had the wrong information about them for years, and I was knee deep in this advocacy. Wow. So it can happen to anybody, and you have to be open to the new information and then, you know, changing your point of view.
So take us back for a second. So back, if we look at, 13 years ago, I guess, 14 years ago?
Meredith died 15 years ago, and I got into the advocacy 12 years ago, so.
So take back then to 15 years ago. So we all heard the story. The story was tabloid fodder. There were all these nicknames that came up. Everyone had all these preconceived notions. How long was Amanda actually in prison?
4 years. She got out in 2011, the end of 2011, if I remember right.
So she was
incorrect. That's incorrect. Let me think. It was, yeah, I know. It's like, I need my book. It's over here on the shelf. I need my book.
she was in prison for a few years. And then,
yeah, it was 4 years.
Okay. So then she was let out of prison. Mm-hmm. And then wasn't there something about how she had to go back, or she had to face trial again after?
Well, the Italian prison system, legal system, has stages, and it takes a long time to go through it. Mm-hmm. So when she went through, they have the investigative phase. That's where all the mistakes were made.
Yeah.
And the investigative phase is the piece that runs the entire progression. Mm-hmm. And so she got out of prison. I think it was in 2011 in the end. That's what I'm remembering. And then they go to the appeals.
Mm-hmm.
So she was back in the U.S. when the appeals started.
Okay.
And she was afraid to go back to Italy. And mm-hmm. so there was a lot of talk in the tabloids about arresting her and bringing her back to Italy if she was found guilty. So they were found guilty in the first appeal.
Mm-hmm.
They in Italy, apparently the tradition is just to hold up whatever the first courts had done. And I will caveat that with, it's exactly the same in the United States.
Yeah.
The United States does exactly the same stuff. Mm-hmm. And when you look at legal systems globally, there are very mm-hmm. few fair legal systems.
Yeah.
They're very heavy on whatever the prosecution says is the truth.
Yeah.
And so she went for two different appeals. She was found guilty. It was the first appeal. Sorry. The first appeal in 2011 is where they were found innocent and released.
Okay.
And then it went back to trial and they declared them guilty again. And then they came up for the second appeal. And that was where I believe the Court of Cassation, the Supreme Court in Italy, found them innocent. And so when you get to a judicial truth in Italy, then it's done.
Okay.
So the backing and forth thing for Amanda, her lawyers handled it. Once she was out of Italy, her lawyers handled everything for her.
Okay.
She was not required to come back unless she was found guilty with the Court of Cassation, the final appeal.
So then the time period, so once she's out of prison, then mm-hmm. basically there's another 10 years or so since then in the court of public opinion, where she had this kind of pervading sort of sense of her, of people not quite believing, not quite understanding that there were facts that show that she did not commit this crime.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard her do a couple of interviews where she's talked about sort of finding peace with that, and how some people have said, you know, maybe she should change her name because it's just something that she kind of carries around the rest of her life, this confused impression about her guilt, I guess.
And part of that was because they found her guilty twice.
Yeah.
Found her guilty at the original trial in 2009. found innocent in 2011, found guilty again in 2013, and then found innocent in 2015. I have my book out. I'm looking at the dates again. And, you know, as you can imagine, after finishing this, my brain is mush. And my whole thing is she is innocent. Yeah. So the part of the innocence that I think the general public needs to understand, regardless of what the Italian judicial system did, is that Meredith Kircher proved who her killer was. Amanda and Raffaele were half a mile away when the murder occurred. And the, you know, if you look at this without any of the prejudice, it is an open and shut case that Rudy Guaidé killed Meredith Kircher. And how that happened is something that her family is still searching for. But basically, Meredith had enough evidence on her body to prove who her killer was. And within her bedroom where the murder occurred, there was zero evidence of Amanda and Raffaele. There was nothing there. And so the prosecution said four people fought, you know, had a death fight in the room. They originally said Amanda's employer was involved, and it was her and her employer at the house. Then they changed it a couple of weeks later to her employer and Raffaele. And then when Rudy was caught in December, they got rid of the employer. They put Rudy in place. Back in Seattle, we're like, oh, they must have got that guy's age wrong. And so people were very confused. And I'm not blaming anybody who is confused about this. It was very confusing. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
So as a society, if we look at this, and again, back to the cognitive dissonance issue you were talking about, you know, I've been having this really fun sort of thing working on my master's degree, like the last year and a half. And it's in public interest communications. And one of the areas that we study very closely is how do you create social impact, and how do you create some sort of behavior change? And so there's been a lot of research in that program about how difficult it is to change a mind once a mind is set.
Oh, that's so true.
And I've thought a lot about Amanda in her story, and about how, you know, to this day, if you say the words Amanda Knox, there are some people who might roll their eyes. Some people, you know, God forgive us, might make a sexist joke like Amanda, Foxy Knoxy. I mean, it just brought out the worst in people. And I'm trying to figure out, what do we as a society, trying to be our best selves, What do we learn from this, apart from the fact that tabloid journalism is a big problem, that we all agree. Well, what else do we learn about the way we all kind of like were excitedly participating in this moment of trauma for this young girl?
I think part of it comes down to, you know, just basic human nature. We're all driven by gossip. Gossip is the oldest form of communication. It was how, you know, oral communication was gossiping about tribes, gossiping about food we created, gossiping about how to do that basket over there that holds water better than this one. So this is something that's intrinsic in human nature. And it played out in this. And this is also something that plays out every day in the news. The other thing is critical thinking. And I think as Americans, we may have become complacent in trusting our media too much over the last, you know, 50, 60 years or so, and we've forgotten about critical thinking. And so if we were to change anything about how we behave and how we look at the media, I would say bring back critical thinking. And I think a lot of people feel the same way, but also study gossip and how that works. And, you know, essentially what was going on between the tabloids and mainstream media was a form of gossip. Tabloids would gossip about something. Mainstream media was looking for filler. And so they borrowed from it a lot. And this is something that I think a lot of people don't realize, how much mainstream media borrows from tabloid media and social media as well. They're always looking for a buzz. These three pieces were something I was not even aware of before this happened. And now I see it all the time. And so I'm really cast a critical eye on everything I look at now. And I didn't do that 15 years ago.
Have you followed much of Monica Lewinsky's redemption arc?
She is an amazing woman.
Yeah, and listening to her. And there's some similar, rhetoric here where she's talked about how she was kind of the first social media victim because it was just people going crazy back when the internet was first getting going.
And
I think about that a lot because there's so much that, we have research that shows that the things that we remember the most on social media are the things that make us angry. And so the social media machinery is set up to try to elicit an emotional response from us, because that will make us click. That will make us get angry and share something. And I feel like Amanda is all kind of integrated into some of those larger, more frustrating components of our personalities as Americans, that people were all forwarding the story along with kind of a prurient sort of interest of watching her downfall. It's just really a sad thing. It's sad to see.
I completely agree with the anger, completely. This was the biggest driver in Italy and Great Britain against Amanda, was so angry. And, she killed that girl. And, and then you bring in all the other stuff, the American, the white girl, the privilege, blah, blah, blah. But the anger was the biggest driver.
Tell us about Amanda now. What is she doing now? Without giving any confidence away of, like, you don't have to give her address or anything.
Well, and frankly, I'm really, really kind of a guard. I don't like to gossip about her at all. Yeah. But I will say she's doing wonderfully. She is still in a healing process, as you can imagine. But she's one of the strongest people I've ever seen. And when you look at her family, you see it too. The way that her family came to her aid and the things they did, the entire system is very, very strong. And so that reflects back on Amanda. And
she has a podcast now, right?
She does. Yeah. Labyrinth. And she's also done some work with Vice. And broadly. And frankly, I think if anybody wants to know anything about Amanda, go to her podcast and listen. Go to Broadly and listen. Go to Vice and listen. Mm-hmm. Her stuff is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And she, like when she did the Scarlet Letter Report, I just listened to like three or four of those. And then I became hooked on it because she was interviewing women that I absolutely have nothing in common with, who were vilified and slut shamed in the media. Yeah. And as I'm listening to their stories, I'm like identifying with all sorts of stuff that I dealt with as a woman at a way, way, way smaller level, but throughout my life.
And I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but, I'm a speaker with Humanities Washington. I speak about working on Capitol Hill and being sexually harassed about 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. Yes.
Yes. When I worked for Bob Packwood.
Yes.
I now give a talk about that issue. And it's really interesting because during that experience, it was only 30 years ago, but I often tell people that during that experience, one of the reasons that Senator Packwood gave for harassing me was because I quote unquote used to wear short skirts. And so during the investigation with the ethics committee, they said, the senator claims that you wear short skirts. And that's one reason that he harassed you. And I was like, okay. And they said, will you stand up? And during the deposition, I had to stand up. And they said, for the record, her skirt's professional in length. And I share that story all the time because my daughters, who are real big feminists, are just blown away that only 30 years ago, you would have to stand up to show the length of your skirt. It's all part of this narrative that our country has had for so long of seeing the woman as deserving of something that happens to her.
Well, and it, you know, and it makes me giggle when you talk about the skirt, but it also makes me incredibly angry that that you had to stand up and do that. You know, it's like, oh, this is so Bob Packwood couldn't be a rapist, right? You know, how come we aren't talking about him wanting to rape and sexually assault people? Can't he control himself?
Yeah, and I got the last laugh. Now himself, I'm giving
why is he in Congress?
I'm giving a speech about him.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about the book now. I know we're almost out of time. I could talk to you forever. Tell us about the book. Where do people find it? What does it kind of cover?
So the book is on Amazon. You know, despite all the political stuff around Amazon, thank God that they're able to set up systems for average people like me.
Yeah.
My dad was a writer, and so he had like an entire drawer full of rejection letters. I don't have any of that. So I'm thankful for Amazon. The book is called Trial by Liar, mm-hmm. and it's also under, you know, Meredith, Rudy, Amanda, and Raffaele's names on the cover.
Yeah.
And it's basically a compilation, like I said, of the crowdsourcing that I did.
Yeah.
What it's mainly for is because I was one of the researchers, the librarians, when we were trying to contact mainstream media and get the word out about the innocence of Amanda and Raffaele, friends of Amanda and Amanda's family and Raffaele's family had given people within the advocacy paperwork to mm-hmm. kind of help the public. And so over the course of the last 13 years, I've been tapped more than once for, mm-hmm. you know, hey, what can you tell me about this? And it made me drag my files out of the closet like 3 times.
Yeah.
So yeah. Basically I wrote the book so I can point at it and go read that first. And it's sourced it, and it, in a kind of a funny way, it's exactly what I needed 13 years ago when I started working on this case with the advocacy. I was always chasing down some fact, some yeah. piece of paper in some file somewhere. And so the book kind of is that. It is the entire 10 year plus
yeah.
of Amanda and Raffaele in, you know, what they went through in the court system. Mm-hmm. It's meshed in with different reports from forensic specialists like Greg Hempinkian over at Boise State University. Mm-hmm. He's with the Innocence Project, so he does a lot of this, and yeah. he helped their family. And there is a host of mainstream media and tabloid media articles that are interspersed. Everything is in exact chronological order as it happened. And so I think that's really important for anybody reviewing this case or any case similar to it. Do a timeline.
Yeah.
And once you see everything in order, it changes mm-hmm. your perception. This is the critical thinking we're discussing.
Yeah.
And so the book was set up for average people, but it was also set up for documentarians or journalists who are seeking research. It has a fairly large bibliography and mm-hmm. Several appendices that are full of sources, as many sources as I could cram into this thing. And then then the body of the book is just in a very simple timeline format. In the beginning of the book, there's a user guide. So that kind of gives everybody an idea of how I approach this mm-hmm. because it's a multi-layered problem. It's very, very complex. There were all mm-hmm. sorts of things I left out just because it would have been too complex.
Yeah.
And I think the most beautiful thing of the book for me is not only showing Amanda and Raphael's innocence and, yeah. you know, that they're good civic citizens, but it also gave Meredith a voice. Mm-hmm. And so here in this book is, you know, using the information given to me by FBI agents and yeah. forensic engineers and the timeline and reading all the different pieces about Meredith's death in the case file. Here is her voice. And I think that's what's been missing a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly what her family has always said.
Yeah.
And in simplicity, she proves that Rudy killed her. and that she walked in on a burglary and he was in a different room. She didn't see him. And then she became trapped in her bedroom and they struggled and fought. And this is a story that so many women have gone through around this world, and it's not unusual.
Yeah.
It's not a strange story. There's nothing creepy and weird like witchcraft about it. So the fact that people can hold Amanda, you know, that she knows something more is comical when you really look at the facts and you realize Meredith is telling people, this is who killed me. And for people to go, well, you know, but Amanda, you know, to me, that's when you get to the point of, yeah, just shut up. I don't even want to hear you anymore. You know, just stop.
So one last question for you, Karen.
Yeah.
I think, and this is just, there's so much to talk about this. I mean, there are other issues around tabloids and how we don't really give people a fair shot in our justice system, to the way women are seen, to the shaming of women. There's just so many things, but one last thing I would love to just ask about is, I feel like our society saw a shift after Amanda in terms of this narrative that creeps up when parents send their kids abroad. Like there's now more of a fear narrative. And no matter what people think of Amanda, I've heard parents over the years say, oh, my daughter wants to go abroad. Oh my goodness. Whether that's afraid of being murdered, afraid of being accused of murdering, afraid of being, you know, pulled into something. Has that been something that you've heard people chat about? And what do we do to help people still see travel and life and experience as full of possibilities rather than fear? I heard Amanda say something really beautiful about that, by the way, where she was saying, you know, people should not see the world as a scary place. This was a bad incident, but it's not as if people should stop exploring the world. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And what you're describing to me is something that I've seen on Vashon in particular. And I look at it in terms of, prior to Amanda's situation, personally, I had seen hundreds of kids go off and study abroad. And, you know, I cut hair here on the island. A lot of my young clients would grow up, go to college, come back for the summer and tell me of their adventures. So I heard hundreds and hundreds of stories. Amanda was the outlier. You know, she was the one that, yes, it did happen. Yes, it could happen. So the biggest lesson in that is, for parents is, and for anybody traveling, know your rights. Know that when you are in a country, and even if your cell phone gets stolen and you have to deal with the police, you need to call for backup. And the only backup a lot of us have are the consulates. What we get wrong is that the consulates are not going to write in like the Marines and rescue us. That is up to us. We are our own first line of defense. The consulates will offer you where to find a lawyer and where to find an interpreter. And that's about it. They'll monitor your situation, but that's it. And, you know, so read the Foreign Affairs Manual. Chapter 7 deals with the arrest of a foreign, you know, of an American abroad, or any kind of situation like that, if you die or anything, what to do. The other thing is, when you're sending your children abroad, talk to your university, make sure that your child is enrolled in classes that teach them their rights and what to do in these situations. And if your university doesn't have those classes, do it on your own. Don't send your kids abroad to study without having a single clue. And this is something that I noted with the European students, in particular the British, because we speak English. They were always shocked by how naive American students are. And part of that is because when we travel from state to state, it's basically the same. You know, we have to pay a little closer attention to being in New York or being in the deep South, you know, being in Los Angeles for safety's sake, and it's different environments in all three of those places. But essentially, when the kids travel around the US, the cops are basically the same everywhere. But when you're traveling from country to country in Europe, that's not the case. The laws are different in each country, the language different in each country, the police are different in each country. And that's something that our average people traveling and our students especially need to understand. And I understand that after this case happened, that the University of Washington did change some of their advice for students who want to travel abroad. I believe still that they are a little more aware and close to the vest. And part of this is because of what happened to one of their students. And I think until, you know, it's the same old thing. Until you go through it, you just don't know. and so a lot of people learned here on Vashon, over in Seattle, a lot of people who know Amanda personally, a lot of people who heard about her situation, a lot of people who read it in the paper and watched it on the news, everybody's perception of traveling abroad changed. And I think that's a good thing. You know, and don't use fear, use awareness.
I like that. Well, I just want to say thank you for doing this. I'm definitely going to get the book Trial by a Liar, and it's on Amazon.
On Amazon, yes.
And if people want to hear more about Amanda, they should go listen to her podcast.
Definitely. And
Labyrinth, I think, is the one that I've heard.
Yeah.
So yeah, people can seek that out too. Well, Karen, this has been so great, and it's fine that we've done without video. Let's see if we can turn it on here at the last minute. I'm going to turn mine on so I can say goodbye.
Here we are.
Hi, we're back.
I think it did get better once I moved back over to the desk. It's a different background. It's on my Rainier beer commercial.
So. I love it. It's great. That's an old time Northwestern. So I love it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. That was so great.
Yeah, it was really, thank you so much. I'm very pleased and glad to get the word out about the book. I want to end with one thing.
Yeah.
If you're following cases on, you know, like legal cases, or you know somebody who is involved in a legal case, I cannot stress how important a timeline is. And it's something, again, that I would have never thought of until I did it.
Yeah.
And knowing people, you know, watching the Innocence Project, when you see people out there who are struggling because they're poor or they need, you know, don't have like a really good legal defense or any support, this is something they can do themselves, that they have within their power to do their own timeline, get their case file, go through it piece by piece, put everything in chronological order, because it brings up memories and you'll go, oh yeah, this one thing, this is what I was doing. And I'm aware of a case where the young man was at home watching TV when somebody accused him of murder. And this is something I've been saying all along, is do this timeline, plug in what you were doing, because you can literally go into the internet and look up those shows, what time they were. I mean, I found out stuff about stuff the kids were watching in 2007 that's still on the internet right now. And so this is something when you're picking apart a puzzle, picking apart something, use a timeline. It is such an incredibly useful tool. And it's something that helped Vashon. Yeah. When I was writing my investigative series back in 2011, I just naturally went to a timeline because that's something that I use personally. Yeah. And it ended up being the thing that helped me take apart the mess that had happened in Italy for Vashon. And when that happened, everybody was like, oh my God, this is awful. And we totally support her family. So we literally went from like about a third of the island totally supporting the Knox family to about 99%. And it was all because of timelines and all because I'm a crazy researcher and I dig through the page 15 on Google. So this is, you know, take that with you. Know your rights. If you have a problem, start a timeline.
All right. Well, thanks, Karen. Again, it's just great talking to you, and I'm going to definitely get the book. And when you do talk to Amanda, just, I let her know that it add me to the pile of people who's just really inspired by the bravery and the positive energy she's bringing after life gave her some real bad.
That just always makes me cry. She's just handled the whole thing so well. I'm so proud of her, you know, one of the auntie grandmas in the community that is just incredibly proud of, you know, swinging back from this horrible situation to being such a positive, helpful person.
Yeah.
And that is her personality, her core personality. If you don't know anything else about her, understand that she's a good, helpful person. And I feel like if the British people knew that about her, they would probably, it would soften how they feel. But a lot of them are still very steeped in the myth that she had something to do with Meredith's death.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just want to shake them and go, listen to Meredith, listen to Meredith.
Oh, all right, Carol. Well, thank you again.
Okay. You're welcome. Thank you so much.
All right. We will definitely, get the book, Trial by Liar, on Amazon. And thanks so much for all you've done, Amanda.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was my pleasure. You know, volunteers, we just keep volunteering and doing stuff.
All right. Well, this has been a great conversation for Washington Game Changers. And I'm Lori Hennessy, and we'll be back next month with another person doing good in the community. In the meantime, you can follow along. We're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook. You can follow League of Education Voters everywhere. But if you go to our website, which is educationvoters.org, there is a tab there about Washington Game Changers that shows all of the different podcasts we've done. And stay tuned, everyone, for the next one. So until then, everyone, take care and have faith that there are people like Karen out there. Thank you, Karen.